I am here with Mr. Kirkwood today, Sean, who is the director of training for Fieldcraft Survival. I used to work for this guy, man. What an ass.
What a gift I gave you
to work
with me. It was like a present.
Do you remember? Like... So Sean ran sniper school. When I got there, we got there at the same time. And so he was my boss.
Pretty much invented sniper school.
Pretty much. I mean. So we were there working for about a year. And then the Ranger Wing that I was in Ireland asked me if I wanted to come to an international counter-terrorist sniper course in Ireland. And I was like, there's no way they'll let me go. So I go to Sean. And Sean's like, hey, if you get an invitation, an official one, I'll send you. So I got to go to Ireland for 3 weeks to my old unit, like 20 years after I left, and go to a sniper course. And it was awesome. Thanks for that.
No problem. I'm here to help.
Me and another guy went. And I remember we were driving, and he saw a gas station. He was like, oh my God, gas is cheap here. It's not as expensive as he thought. And it was like $4 or something. And I was like, that's per liter. It's euros. Anyway.
What I saw this morning bringing up? Mike Rodriguez. Rodriguez? He is the president and the CEO of the Global War on Terror Memorial that is getting built in Washington, D.C.
Oh my
God.
He's
in charge of that whole...
Wow.
That whatever organization, it's a nonprofit that's taking donations. I saw him on Fox News this morning with Mission Barbecue.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. They gave him like a $1.4 million check.
He got messed up, man.
Yeah.
His TBI.
He's got that contact in. I haven't talked to him in a few years. I saw him on TV, but he's. I guess it's like the World War II Memorial or Korean War Memorial, Vietnam War. It's that level of memorial for the Global War on Terror. And he's like the president and CEO of it.
Good for him.
Google it. I just found out this morning it existed. So if you're out there doing it, Google it and donate.
That's
a good deal.
Yeah, he was a 7 Group guy.
Yep.
And then he worked at Sniper School with us.
Yeah.
That's cool. We're going to talk about asking why. All right?
It's funny because we
were talking about this, and there's so much stuff out there, especially in the training world. And if you really step back and look at it, it makes no sense. Now, just now when I was... getting my stuff ready to come in here, I was thinking, you know, I grew up in, you know, as a kid, as a Catholic, right?
Yeah.
And asking why, like, I remember going, Noah's Ark makes no sense. Why didn't the lions just eat the zebras? They were in the Middle East. Where did they get giraffes? I don't think there's any giraffes. Like, this makes no sense. Yeah. So I was asking why from a very young age. And I didn't get
any
good...
Is that when Rulers came out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was an ass-kicking right there. A little blind faith was what they wanted. But I think it comes to maturity later on in life when you look back at some of the stuff that we've done, too, and you're just like, that made no sense.
Yeah.
Because you're taking on faith that it's the right thing. But when you really look at it critically, it makes no sense. And it's just, that's the way it's always been done. So people just take it and run with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and that's the two things. That's one of the things that's always been bad about training is you walk into an environment, whether it's military, wherever you're training, whatever you're doing, I don't care what the subject is. If you ask, well, why do we do that? The answer generally is, well, that's the way we've always done it, and it works. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't work. Maybe I'm not saying you have to change everything.
Mm.
But if you ask the question of why, well, why do we do it that way? And good techniques will stand on their own.
Yeah.
You know, bad techniques will go away, or they'll be altered and fixed to meet whatever the new requirement is for whatever you're doing. But it's a personality flaw in a lot of trainers, I think, is I'm the expert in this. I know this way. And I want to continue to be the expert, so I'm not going to go out of my comfort zone and learn a new way. So I just keep regurgitating. And especially if it works for somebody, this is the way I did it and it worked for me, fine. Well, that's awesome. But that doesn't mean the environment hasn't changed. You know, the M1 Garand worked fine to win World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We changed the rifle over the years for various reasons, good or bad. Maybe it was a good decision or a bad, but you can't always fall back on, well, that's the way we've always done it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise... The other thing I say is one day you're working in a museum and you don't even realize it.
Yeah.
You know?
The people also get very tied to what they learn in school, right? That's why me and you both were adamant when we were running sniper school is like everything we put out has to be 100%. Like it has to be the right answer as far as we know or at that point, right? Because people will take that to the ground. I learned this in sniper school and it is right because anything you teach there, people will take it as gospel.
Yeah.
And you know, for a long time, things were thought at sniper school that weren't 100% true, but it was all they had at the time. There was some assumptions made because they didn't have ballistic calculators, and they just, that's what they figured out through trial and error, I guess, but it wasn't always 100% true. And I think...
Well, there was a lot of information gaps because we didn't have really the average person didn't have the technology to know the answer. But now, I mean, it's like an iPhone in your hand. You have the world in your hand, especially with ballistic calculators. So why wouldn't you use that?
Yeah.
Now, we still got resistance. I got a lot of resistance on it. But it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's go back a little bit into the old 90s when you were in there. Oh, yeah. What year did you come in? 92?
87.
87. You're old, man.
I'm ancient, yeah. My first duty station was West Germany. There was two countries back then.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. 87, I was in Lebanon.
Yeah.
In 87, yeah. So when you came in, that was your first duty station from basic.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
right
cool.
Right out of basic.
Did you do any travel?
Did I what?
Did you do any traveling?
Minimal. I went to Spain. Any place that there was a bar and a party, I generally tried to go. But I didn't go see any of the cool stuff you should see in Europe.
I know. Yeah.
I landed in Germany on my 18th birthday, and I could drink as much as I wanted to. And the rest is fuzzy history.
So you joined at 17.
I joined at 17. Mm-hmm. I actually quit high school and joined the Army. Had
nice.
To get signed.
It's yours.
My mom had to sign for me. I know. So I signed up and went in, and then my first duty station was Germany. It was a lot different philosophy back then because a lot of the training was built, any training was generally built around either the Cold War, Russia's going to go come across the fold of the gap and invade West Germany scenario, which was theoretical.
Believe it or not, Vietnam, Sean, when I was in Germany in 98, we were still fighting that war. We were still training for a Soviet invasion.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They were going to come across with armored divisions, and that's all that they... And that was a theoretical... It could have happened. Yeah, I guess that's an option to train for. But and then the other side of that, like I said, was Vietnam. That was the other war that we were kind of focusing on. And all the, you know, brigade and commanders and, you know, generals of that time were Vietnam. They were all had been in Vietnam generally. Mm-hmm. Maybe as a platoon leader, company commander, whatever. Mm. So a lot of the institutional knowledge and training methodology was built around that. I remember one, the first why that I remember ever really having is we were in a mechanized infantry unit, right? So I'm in this big metal box, an M113 personnel carrier, right? And I'm in this squad in the back, got my weapon. So
bullet magnet.
Yeah, we were in the field in the wintertime, cold as hell, and we were going to have hot chow brought to us one day, which is like an awesome treat, right? So they loaded up a bunch of Marmite big thermos containers full of hot chow, and they set it up in this wood somewhere. So we pull up, and we're all tactical, and we're all camouflaged, and we tactically get out of our vehicles, and then we had what was called tactical chow.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to stay, you know, 10 yards apart going through the chow line. And I remember going through the chow, and when we weren't in the chow line, like actively getting food on plates, we had to take a knee and like face out.
Yeah.
Like the enemy was all around. And I remember going, getting my food, happy to get my food, but thinking, why are we doing this? If the enemy threat is so high, why are they bringing us hot chow? Shouldn't we be in a defensive position or patrolling to go kill these guys that are going to kill us while I'm getting my chili mac?
Yeah.
But it was just, it was like, you didn't really ask. It was like, okay, this is tactical chow. This is what you got to do. And I just, it's a dangerous situation if I got to face out and pull security in between the chili mac and the green bean station.
You get shot by a sniper when you're getting your cornbread, man.
Yeah, I'm like, what is this?
You probably did a lot of NBC stuff back then.
Tons.
Yeah,
tons.
In the 90s. And that, again, that was very check the box, right? Yeah. And it was very, like you went through all the pieces, but when you look back, it didn't make a lot of sense, really. Yeah. Like,
If it was quiet enough, you could hear your company commander checking the block.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, yeah. you know, you have like 3 seconds to put your mask on and seal it, right? Yeah. Oh my God, that's a bad one, right? And then decontamination, complete check the box, right? The charcoal NBC suits that we had that you just die in, right?
The good thing about them in West Germany in the winter was they were warm. So whoever we did it there was like awesome. Let's put on our mop suits.
Yeah. You don't get anywhere as a private asking why. They don't like that. And I did ask why a lot because I would experience private. They didn't like that at all. Yeah. You know, I had an E7 platoon sergeant like crush me one time in an AAR because I said something. And I don't know if I've ever told you this. And I pulled him aside. I was PFC, I think. And I pulled him aside afterwards and I was like, what the hell is your problem? Like, I probably shouldn't talk to an E7 like that. And he said, I can't have you stealing my thunder. That's what he said.
That is a bad
thing. Talk about an insecure E7.
Yeah.
When
you can't be smarter than me.
Yeah. We were in Kuwait as well, and my platoon leader, who was a jackass, we were walking across the desert, and he had a plugger, you know, GPS, and he had the light on the whole time. You could see it for miles. And I busted him in the AAR, and he pulled me aside, and he said, I don't appreciate you busting me out like that. And I said, hey, everybody's here to learn. That's the point, right?
It's not a group hug.
Yeah, yeah. So what else? In the early days, there were probably a lot of that.
Yeah.
Check the box.
There was lots of that check the box. Like even the normal training you did, like let's just go back to rifle qualification.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a check the block thing.
Oh, yeah. Sitting in a foxhole?
Sitting in a foxhole, you know, a perfect foxhole, sandbag positions, you know, or just, you know, where the targets are going to come up. I mean, just the qualification itself was kind of, was there's no really why behind it. Why are we doing this? Well, what's the point of all that?
It has evolved slightly.
Yeah.
Now to get behind cover and they shoot from an E and they shoot standing. But that only recently changed, I think.
Yeah.
That foxhole was going on until recently.
Yeah.
And it was just to check the box, right? It was just, okay, you're in this defensive position and you're going to shoot these pop-up targets out to 300.
Yeah.
And you don't have to hit anything at 300. You can hit one and two and move on, right?
Yeah.
What else?
Yeah, there was just a lot of institutional stuff that came out that, you know, once the war started, we just realized was garbage. And, you know, in the '80s, again, it's the lessons learned were sporadic. Like even the combat, like, you know, Grenada and things that happened in the '80s were little, you know, were like lightning strikes, you know, and the people that were involved in that learned a lot of lessons that were in combat, but I think a lot of it never really got disseminated, or if it did, there was just it was just well, that's a one off. You know, that just
we're
happened.
Bad.
One time.
Like the military, we're bad at harnessing lessons learned.
Oh yeah,
and all the lessons learned in Iraq, Afghanistan, a lot of them are going to get relearned in the next war.
Yeah.
It just that's the way it is. The what about the Q course? What were they teaching on the Q course? Because I've got a couple on the Q course. Like we were still doing the poles. With the string, with the 35mm camera hanging, and the plane flies over
plane
and
with
scoops
the boat
it up.
Scoop
yeah.
It up. Yeah, what do they call it? The MPU message pickup.
I can't remember.
I remember that.
Message pickup thing. Yeah,
that was like an old Vietnam.
It was.
And before,
like
you couldn't land an airplane, so they'd fly by with a boat anchor and get a message out.
Yeah,
and we're sitting there with satellite radios. Yeah. I mean,
I know.
It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah,
you know?
There's some of those old school things are cool because, especially as a Green Beret, you're training Indig who don't have all your technology, right? So some of that stuff you have to maintain in order to team up. But people are very reluctant to modernize too, right?
Yeah.
Like Morse code only went out a few years ago, I think, in the Q course because they're like, look, we need to train computers and networking and all this other, you know, satellite communications, and we just don't have room for everything.
Yeah.
I think
I can hear there's an argument to be made for, you know, you don't want to get rid of everything. Like just because it's an older technique or a technique that used often does not necessarily mean that it's a technique you don't need to have in your tool bag.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just people that get tied to it and they refuse to, like, it's, you know, if you're not able to have an aircraft pick up a message with a boat anchor flying from it, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And that mentality is just what's bad in the whole training world is like, if you don't do this thing, whatever it is, everything you do is garbage.
Yeah.
And it's just not true.
I mean, very, very visible now that we are in. As much as we hate it, we're in the tactical space a little bit and we're in the social media space. And you'll get a lot of guys who teach a certain skill set. Usually it's firearms. And they try to make it theirs, right? They try to find this little niche thing. And they talk like if you don't do it exactly like this, you'll never hit a target again in your life, right?
Never.
And anybody who speaks and says something different just gets attacked because you got to shut people up, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. It's like I have I'm an opinionated guy, so are you.
Mm-hmm.
I would never, ever.
I'm not.
Except for you. You used to be. You went to therapy, but I am. Okay, I'm really opinionated. But I would never go out there and out in a public space and just like go after somebody about that technique is garbage and this and that. And some of the comments you read and the, it's just like, come on, man.
Yeah. I feel sorry for them almost,
you know,
man. Yeah.
Even if I disagree with you. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that I disagree with people that are doing out there, but everybody's doing their own version of it. You got to decide for your own. And I would never go out and attack somebody for what they're teaching, even if it's completely like opposite of what I think.
Yeah.
I'd be like, you know, all right, man, get out there and do it. Because there's a lot of techniques with everything, you know, and everybody has a different experience and a different outlook on things. And it's really hard to define, well, this is the only way you can do it. I was watching like a World War II video the other day about handgun training, just you know, watching it, just to kind of see like one of them old, hey, today we're preaching a 45 caliber, that old-timey like War Department video. And I'm watching some of the techniques on there, and some of them I was like, ooh, they're going to do that? But I'm like, these guys won World War II.
They didn't,
I mean, I'm not saying it was perfect what they're doing. I'm sure there's better ways, and there are better ways, and I would never do a lot of those techniques. But am I going to go out and bash that guy for teaching it now and go, oh, that dude don't know what he's talking about?
Yeah. Well, the tactical space is so toxic because there's tons and tons and tons of tactical companies, and they're all fighting for scraps, right?
Yeah.
They're all trying to get that customer.
Yeah.
So they find it hard to elevate themselves above the crowd, so they try to pull people down.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually a good template. If you're looking for a company to train with, look at, and I mean, we're not everywhere, right? But if you look at a company and look at their social media and look at how they talk about other companies and how they bash other companies, and if they'll do that, they'll bash you behind your back for being a screwed up student, or they'll talk trash, or it's just a toxic environment. I think it's a good template for you to vet a company.
Yeah.
Look at the how they treat other companies. And it's probably a good way.
Well, it's like when we were in doing force mod stuff before, it's like one of the biggest things that would make me flip a switch on a company is like, if you coming to me telling me how bad all the other companies are and your widget is better than their widget or their widget is bad. And I don't want to hear about that. I want to hear how good your stuff is.
Yeah.
And if it is awesome, I'll be the judge of that. But as soon as you start bashing another company,
it's just,
I don't really want to hear
it. Puts you in a bad light.
Yeah.
You know? Winners focus on the finish line, not everybody else. Right. When we got to sniper school together, and we started looking at, because we both came out of the war, multiple tours to combat. We were both snipers in a CIF company. You're in fifth, I was in third. Multiple trips to the ICTF, the Iraqi Counter-Terrorist Force. A lot of combat time, right? And we got to sniper school in 2008. Now, almost every mission we did in Iraq was at night, because we were on reverse cycle. We slept during the day, and we were going after bad guys in their bed down location.
Yeah.
Right? But when we both got there, there was like one night shift.
Yeah.
Right?
And it was garbage.
And it was just check the box.
It was like a familiarization bar.
Yes. It was stupid.
There was no
right?
training involved.
No, it was bad. Yeah. So there was, the course had gotten kind of stagnant, I think.
It was the same course I went to 10 years prior, 12 years prior.
And
nothing had changed.
The first couple of days was shooting iron sights with the Palma sights and the M24 with the, what do you call that, sling? The one you put on your arm and you wrap it
you
around.
Wrap yourself up, and they even had the oven mitts.
The oven mitts, And you lock that sling in and you can't move.
Yeah.
And 3 days of shooting iron sights. And we talked about getting people on an optic earlier. And it wasn't a frivolous, you know, quickly made decision. We actually talked a lot. We talked to Todd Hodnett about it. And because nobody else did it doesn't mean it was wrong.
Yeah.
And I was trying to understand the training methodology. But like you said earlier, nobody could explain the why to us. Like the guys who'd worked there for years, they couldn't explain the why.
Well, what really got me on that one specifically was, you know, okay, we're teaching people. The idea was you got to teach them basic, basic marksmanship skills, all that stuff. I agree with that. But as soon as we were done doing those basic marksmanship skills with position and everything like that with those iron sights, your whole body position and the way you shot that rifle changed as soon as you put an optic on it.
Yeah.
Everything changed. And I was like, why are we teaching them this way and then immediately changing everything? Because shooting an iron sight is not exactly the same as shooting a scope. Where your face is, where, you know, how your body aligns,
eye relief,
everything changes. So we're basically spending a week of wasted time. And really, you know what that week got us when we got rid of that? We added gas guns.
Yeah.
Because before we weren't shooting gas guns.
Yeah.
They were only shooting bolt guns because, you know, snipers didn't shoot gas guns.
Yeah.
And which that's an old methodology. Why aren't we shooting gas guns? They're not as accurate.
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
I remember you, they were then.
Yeah.
They started getting as accurate. Yeah. I remember you were the guest speaker at the sniper comp.
Yeah.
And you were saying that you know, you lessons learned in combat and that, and you're like running down the street in Baghdad trying to reload a bolt gun with an internal magazine. Yeah. Not great.
Not a good idea.
Not a good idea. It's the
wrong weapon to have in your hand during a, during a gunfight.
Yeah.
No, but there was just, there was a lot of things that nobody ever asked why. They were like, I'm going to go to the schoolhouse and, you know, I'm going to touch the magic and then when I go back to my unit. But what I realized is I had went to school before the war.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to combat and I infilled as a sniper my first time, I realized that I didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I realized that I knew how to zero my gun and basically slip the scales and call a little bit of wind. That was about it.
Mm.
I didn't know how to do hides. I didn't know how to, you know, move the right way. I didn't know more. I knew less than I thought I knew. And luckily I survived a couple close calls because of that knowledge gap. So when I got to the course and started and took it over, I was like, that stuff's changing now. Because we were in the middle of the war and I had a good chain of command. And I just, again, I didn't go in there like a bull in a china shop. I kind of went in there and I started asking, well, explain this to me. You remember, I had all the instructors pitch me their classes that they had. And then we started asking, well, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. Why are we doing that? And then a lot of them just, they couldn't explain it. If they could explain it and it made sense to me. Like, I remember one specifically, I was like, why are we still doing stalks? Because I remember being on the side of, I want to get rid of stalks because these guys aren't doing the, you know, moving, crawling on the ground, and you know, doing. I'm not saying it's not a sniper skill that they would need, but at the time, I thought we should get rid of them. Now, in hindsight, I realized that that was a bad opinion on my part. I think I was wrong on that one, and I forget who the instructor that told me about that was, but they said, hey, look, basically a stalk is a consolidation of movement, camo, and concealment, selecting a firing position, IDing a target. There's a lot of different tasks that are involved with that. So that's why I think we should keep stocks. And I was like, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I was taking it too literal. I was going like, because I had just come out of combat. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I never saw that in combat. I was kind of making the same mistake that a lot of guys make that got into my position.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of a light bulb went on my head at that point. I was like, you know, that's a good reason why we're doing that. It's a consolidation of tasks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they do that actually in combat or not, doesn't really matter. We're observing a lot of different tasks in one package that we can decide if that person knows them or not. So we kept stocks and they stayed.
Yeah.
But not everything could be answered like that. Why weren't we shooting past 800 meters was another question I asked.
Yeah.
We were only shooting out to 800 yards and we had the range. Mm-hmm. And what I was told when I asked the why from one of the senior instructors was it's beyond the capability of the firearm.
Yeah.
Now I had just come from Todd Hodnett's place where we were doing mile shots with 1,680 yards with 308s. Yeah. Now, is that a shot I'd want to take with a 308? No. But it's still shooting as fast or running as fast as a 45 out of the barrel at 680 yards, so I could kill somebody at that range. No, I don't want to ever take that shot. It's too long of a shot, but it's way farther than 800. So what do? We started training past 800. And really, we only stopped because of range restrictions. We could only get out to maybe 1,200.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what our 1,000 or 1,200
on 67, we could go to 1,000. Yeah,
yeah. So we pushed out as far as we could go,
and the 300 Win Mags were coming on board at that point.
Yeah.
And then we got ballistic calculators and better night vision and the night thing too. We started hammering night training.
Movers,
movers.
Yeah, and even the stress chutes that we put in.
Yeah,
running and gunning, moving from position to position. Now that's what assaulters do. Well, no. I've been running through the streets in Solder City where I had to run for my life and be in a gunfight. No, that's just, snipers have to do it too.
Yep. What other schools did you go to that you had to change the mindset on? I know you worked the Captain's Career Course and stuff like that.
You mean as far as an instructor?
Yeah, as far as an instructor or a guy, the guy in charge, or even one of the instructors that looked at stuff and go, this doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I would say the SEER school when I worked there. And again, I can't speak 100% on one subject, but I had an opinion on.
So SEER is
survival, escape, resistance, and evasion, or survival, evasion, resistance, and escape.
I say it both ways. Yeah.
But you know, my opinion was I mostly did the part where you're captured, like how to resist interrogation and what to do, what not to do. That was my section of the training. And what I noticed immediately was we were training. There's three different spectrums of captivity that you can be in, and one of them is wartime. Well, the least likely one for that over the last 30 years that Americans have been involved in is wartime prisoner of war.
Mm-hmm.
But our whole scenario was built around the least likely scenario.
Yeah, when you talk about wartime, you talk about a conventional army war, not Afghanistan or Iraq.
World War II type war. And we haven't been in any of that since World War II. Mm. And they actually did a 30-year study of, you know, the types of captivity over 30 years. Mm. And there's, I forget the numbers, but basically it was like 92% of them were either hostage detention or peacetime governmental detention. So peacetime governmental detention is a country that we're not at war with.
Yeah.
Is holding me
it's
for
like
some
the guys
reason.
Who got rolled up in Kosovo.
Yes.
That thing. Yeah, yeah.
That's peacetime governmental detention. And honestly, even if you were captured in Iraq, technically, by the definition, that's peacetime governmental detention because we never declared war against Iraq or Afghanistan through Congress. But even if you take those out of the picture, it's still 92% of the thing. So I look at stats and say, when I was there, my argument was, by regulation, we had to train two of those three spectrums. I was like, why are we, then we should dump wartime. Mm. We should only train peacetime governmental and hostage detention because those are the most likely.
Can you, if you got trained on those two, could you revert to wartime?
Yes.
Is it that different?
There's, you know, and all this is, you know, is classified techniques, but yes, the answer is yes.
Can you go the other way? If you train wartime, can you do the peacetime stuff? Is it harder?
It is harder.
Yeah, I'd imagine
it is harder because it's about constraints. You know, honestly, and really this is about the law of land warfare and the Geneva Convention, all that, which not a lot of people follow it anyways other than us. But if they did follow by the rules and we were playing by the rules and you were in a wartime detention, you have – that's the easiest of all three.
Yeah. Well, the most – dangerous part, I assume, and this is, I went to that school a long time ago, is getting rolled up on the battlefield by frontline troops. But once you get processed and move backwards, your survivability rate is very high, right?
Yeah, it increases drastically.
With the peacetime detention, or especially with the hostage stuff, you're always in that very dangerous phase.
Hostage is the most dangerous and the most likely.
Yeah.
For anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, because if you're a military, because hostage is one of the things that'll happen when you're on leave as a service, or could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're deployed to, you know, Kosovo, or you're in doing something in Syria, I mean, that we're not at war with. A lot of most of the missions we're on, especially special operations, you're not in an active war that, you know, we've
declared. What was the argument against that?
That's the way we've all, it really boiled down to, you know, la, fingers in my ears, and that's the way we've always done it, and we'll look at all the work we've done over. It almost became like the last exercise, which, and again, I don't want to be taken wrong, it's a great exercise. Mm-hmm. It's a great scenario-based training event. Awesome. Great. But it almost became a rite of passage more than adjusting to what the force needs.
Okay.
You know, it's like, well, this is the way we've always done it. It's awesome. Because everybody has their awesome experience in SEER.
Mm-hmm.
And you have it, I have it, when, you know, the way it all goes, it's like, it's this memory you have, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it almost became like the Darby Queen in Ranger School. It's an obstacle course, but everybody remembers going through it. It's a rite of passage kind of thing. Are we necessarily training our force actively to be the best they can be in that situation?
Yeah.
I would argue no. I would argue that we are training them well, but we could train them better, was my argument. Not that what we were doing is garbage, because it wasn't. It's a great course. But I think you got to look at it critically and go, I know it's a little out of your comfort zone, but explain to me why if I have 10 incidents and 9 of them are one and one of them is the other, why are we focused on the one? Why aren't we focused on the 9?
Yeah, to get the best product.
And I even had, you know, data. And it was just... It was an organizational lack of will to make that kind of change.
The way SWIC, which is Special Warfare Training Group, and I'm hoping to get the SWIC CSM in here in January and talk to him, but the way SWIC operates is it has uniformed Green Beret instructors who've been on a team for a couple of years, and it also has civilians that are prior special operations that work there. And it can be a great thing, because it gives you that very experienced guy, and they stay there for years, and they're GS, and they're continuity, right, from course to course to course.
Yeah.
But it can also be a double-edged sword, where you get the guy who's like that, where it's like, this is the way we have always done it, and this is what I'm comfortable with, and I don't want to change anything.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's typical government. I mean, you know, I was there's a percentage of civilian GS government or general service instructors that are hired by the Army that are awesome dudes, great. Head on, doing the right thing, pushing hard. But there's a large percentage it's not. There's a large percentage.
And impossible to fire.
Impossible.
Yes.
Yeah, good luck.
Impossible.
I mean, and it's really hard to make change when a lot of people just have the idea, well, I'll just wait this chain of command out because I know you're here for 2 years. I've been here 15 already. I'll wait you out 2 years and slow roll you. You can't really fire me. And then when you leave, I'll convince the new guy that I really know what's taught and what I'm doing, and you don't.
And it happens. All the time.
Yeah. And again, you know, I had good experiences as a GS employee. I enjoyed what I was doing. I had great jobs, and that's not why. Honestly, that's not why I left. I decided to come on to Fieldcraft. Mm-hmm. I did notice that though, and I think as soon as you back to the training thing, as soon as you stop asking yourself why am I doing this way, I don't care what you've been doing. I always say to people, name me one thing you do the same now that you did 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. One thing. I guarantee most people in our life don't have anything in our lives they do the same. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same iPhone. You don't have the same workout routine. You don't eat the same food. You don't go to the same restaurants. Mm-hmm. You don't drive the same car. You know, there's a lot of things you don't do that you did 20 mm-hmm. years ago. It's not because what you did 20 years ago was garbage. It was just because you've evolved over time.
The flip side, because there's pros and cons to everything, the flip side of that is just changing stuff for the sake of changing it. And that happens a lot, too.
Oh, yeah.
Where guys come in and they're like, you know, I laugh, but I say like the officers and NCOs and SWIC, right? Nobody gets a bullet, an excellent bullet on their evaluation report that says kept everything the same because it was working.
Yeah.
Right? So they change things just for the sake of changing them. And then the next guy comes in and changes them back the way they were before.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Well, I had a call from one of the guys I used to work with. He was in A15 long after I was gone. Mm-hmm. I didn't know him in A15, but I met him when I was a civilian working up at Range 37. Well, he's a team sergeant now in A15, you know, and he's a big history guy with the CIF, CRIF companies, and mm-hmm. he knows all the ins and outs. Just a smart guy, and he's into it, right? And we have a good relationship, and he called me. He's like, man, I was telling my guys about, you know, the Black Rifle video of you, and they were in the same company I was in, and they watched it. And I was like, I didn't even know that happened with this company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was like, you know, one day you're the tip of the spear, and the next day you're a dusty picture on the wall. It's just the way it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, but the reason I bring that up is because, you know, they're coming here to do some training. He wants me to come by and do like a little talk with them, just talk mm-hmm. to them. And really what it's about is just you lose that institutional knowledge and you lose the why behind things. And if your experience is all peacetime, which mine was coming up, I mean, mm-hmm. I grew up in the peacetime army. And if that's all you know, training's going to change. And it's not always going to change to the right way. It might change into rangeisms, you know, mm-hmm. that we talk about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it ebbs and flows based on a level of experience that's going on.
Yeah, I was telling you yesterday that when I was in Germany, we had a lot of it's based on the leadership you have, right? Yeah. From the battalion commander down, but we had a crap sergeant major. And we were out training on the range, and we were breaking contact and doing all kinds of things. And then he came out, and like downrange is downrange in front of you, and we were shooting. But when we ran backwards, we had to turn the gun, keep it pointed up and downrange over your right shoulder, and run back with the gun. Like, it was ridiculous.
You didn't do that
like
in combat?
I did not do that in combat.
You
no
really safe so much.
No, it was insane, and that gets trained and hammered into people.
Yeah.
And they go to combat and they're not ready.
Well, and that's what they'll do. That's mm-hmm. what they'll do. And we talked about another one, like in our CQB school. Like, we would go and we would clear our corner, and you'd get into the corner and you'd move your weapon left and right mm-hmm. on either edge of your sector of fire, to left mm-hmm. and right limits of your sector of fire. Now, in a real world, I do that with my eyes, mm-hmm. and I look. Now, why did I do that in school? Because there's people on the catwalk, and they want to see me. I call it the sprinkler. They wanted to see me move my rifle 1 meter from the guy in the corner opposite of me and move my rifle all the way back to my secondary sector of fire again,
mm-hmm.
and then I was good, and I checked the block. So
cooperate and graduate.
Exactly. Yeah. But that, and I understand why the instructors did it. I'm not throwing rocks. I'm just saying that was a trainingism.
Mm-hmm.
Rooms with no furniture in them.
Yep.
I mean, how many rooms did we clear that were empty?
None.
Yeah. You know,
I cleared a room one time in Afghanistan, and it was a big structure, like a big kind of warehouse. We were clearing this whole village, and we were shotgunning all the doors and all that. And we shotgunned this door, and we kicked it in, and we hauled ass in there. and the whole village was using that to take a dump in. And because there was like pieces missing from the back of the building, and they were all climbing in there and crapping on the floor. So the whole floor was covered in human feces. And we breached and entered dynamically and stopped dead in our tracks. Somebody could have been shooting, and I wasn't taking another step. Nasty. Yeah. Sorry, that just flashed into my brain.
Yeah. But it's just, it's these rangeisms and these, nobody asked to why. Why are we doing that? And I remember one of the guys that, when I was a team sergeant, made a big change to the way we, this is back in 06 or 07, mm-hmm. probably 06, made a change based on combat. Jack Nevels, who came from your your company, B23, he came there and took over the CQB course, and he was like, this is not the way we do it. So we're going to institute dynamic CQB, which caused a lot of drama. And but long story short, that was how we were doing it downrange. And so he put it in the course. So a lot of that went away. Well, now, fast forward a few years, they're back to the other ways. Now, again, everybody, I firmly believe everybody's trying to do the right thing. They're doing what they think is right. And but I think there's a lot. It's the path of least resistance just to go to those. Why are we not ask? Why are we doing this?
Jack Nevels ran. He ran Sephardic when I went through.
Yeah.
And when we did combatives, we did taking people down and flex cuffing them, right? Yeah. And his point was, look, and he's a combatives guy. He's a Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy. He's like, look, if I'm arm barring you in the house, if you touch me in the house, you're a combatant, you're getting shot, right? And if I don't shoot you, somebody else will. I'm not wrestling on the freaking ground with you.
A good point to that is, like, look, that was our specific section of the world, what we were doing. Now, if I was a law enforcement officer nowadays, and I would be a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
I would too.
Because you have to be able to do that all the time. Yeah. In our world, you're right. Somebody starts wrestling with you, it's not a wrestling match, it's a gunfight, and everything changes. But law enforcement can't do that. So again, I'm not saying doing combatives is wrong or it's not. It's great. It's awesome. Brazilian jiu-jitsu was great. It just, it doesn't fit into everything.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want, and again, even if you train it, you got to look at, if I have 50 tasks to train, you have to prioritize. You have to decide what's important. Yeah. Like if I'm a special forces guy or a special operator going into a structures, if I have a rifle and pistol, what should I train with more? I should probably train with my rifle because that's what I got in my hands all the time. My pistol's a reserve parachute. Now, if I'm a cop, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
I'm always going to have my pistol and I got to go to my rifle. So that's probably going to be a secondary. But people don't do that analysis. It'd be like if I went to a police station, I became the chief of police somewhere and said, hey, all this pistol work you guys aren't doing anymore. We're doing all rifle. And all I carry is a pistol. That's dumb.
Yeah.
So again, you got to really ask why. You got to ask, why am I doing this? Is this the best technique I could teach it with? If the answer is because it's a great thing that I need to know, a great task, okay, am I training it the best way that I can? Am I using all available information to train this the best way for what my situation? And then if you are, good. It stands on its own. Doesn't even need to have any more discussion.
If you had no background in this world and you were a civilian looking to get better prepared, and you look at all the courses we run, what would you do first?
All the courses we run, first thing I would do is personal security.
Yeah, that's a good one to start
because
with.
Because it's mindset. It's situational awareness. It's using using what's between your ears first.
Yeah.
And to think through problems. That would be the first one that I would probably.
Yeah, medical training. If you don't have any medical training, you need to get some med training.
Yeah, medical training, situational awareness. And then, you know, and then I'd get into, I would start at, you know, like, we have basic, you know, our course names basically changed in 2023. They're changing. So now we have a basic pistol and carbine. And that's obviously where I'd start at step one because it's basic. It's foundational. It's building a foundation. And what I've noticed about the basics over the years is, you know, everybody wants to be outside the box. You know, that's a term you hear. I want to think outside the box.
It's like you have to be conventional before you can be unconventional.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Well, what I want you to be able to do is define the four corners of the box first and then try to get outside of them. And a lot of people, to include well-trained, special, a lot of people in a lot of different aspects, they want to jump right to advanced. And I guarantee you, I don't care what your level of shooting is, we'll just use shooting as an example. If you go to a basic course and slow it down and refocus on the basics, it's going to be value-added for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, basic pistol, basic carbine, and then we go to defensive pistol and defensive carbine. And all that is stepping it up a little bit. you know, because you're in a maybe home defense or you have a little bit of basic skills that you want to expand on. And then we go to performance, which is pushing the envelope even more, outrunning your headlights a little bit and bringing it back. You know, so if you do those in sequence and build that plan for yourself, that's going to be good. I mean, that'll get you well trained in next year. But really, like we said, mindset, medical training is always a priority because if you ever get into it, if there's ever guns out and people are shooting at each other, somebody's going to have a hole in them. So you better get some medical training. But also medical training applies to normal life, car wrecks.
Yeah.
You know, I was coming home from work one day and a car flipped over on the side of the road, ran right off the road, ran into a tree and flipped over on the side of the road. I didn't need my firearm, but medical kit sure helps. And a lot of people are in those situations every day.
Yeah, we talked about the name change for the firearm stuff. And what it does, it puts people of the same skill set in the course together, right? So instructors can focus on pacing that course to the right speed, right? And for basic defensive and dynamic pistol and carbine, right? So you're in with
performance.
People.
Basic, defensive, and performance.
Performance, okay, I'm sorry. So people can weigh where they want to get in. And I'll be honest, if you did those three, then at that point you're buying ammo and running drills, you know what I mean? And you're pretty good at the end of those three because we got phenomenal instructors. But
if you just maintain those skills, I mean, you know, honestly, there's a lot of people that shoot all the time, but I would say that the biggest segment of the society, they don't shoot as much as they want to for various reasons, time, ammo, motivation, whatever it is. But you can be proficient and gain the skills and then keep them up. Maintain. It's like going to the gym and maintaining. You don't just go to the gym and do random stuff. You got a plan. You got a plan for your personal fitness. So if you got a training plan for firearms, have a plan. Go to the if you go to the range once a month and you shoot 50 rounds, but you have purpose behind those rounds, you're better prepared than if you just go blast 200 rounds with no plan.
I've seen that a lot. People just go and burn powder and shoot. They're not shooting drills. They're not isolating certain training goals.
Yeah.
And it's not wasted, but you're not getting the full benefit from what you're doing.
And that's really what you got to look at when you do that. You know, and what we talked about is the why. We're back to the why thing.
Yeah.
Why you do something. Remember back in the 90s? Well, all the way for a long time. What did our med kit consist of back in the 90s?
Field dressing.
There's one little 3x5 field dressing.
And it was a cravat.
And that was it.
Yeah.
And anybody that's ever seen or been around a wound in combat knows that that is nowhere near enough for almost any wound that you're going to see in a gunfight or any kind of trauma. But we carried it for years. And that was what our... And nobody ever asked, well, why do we carry this? How much blood will this soak up?
What's the
most danger? You know, we never talked about it.
It
was just like, there's your med kit. You got to carry it. And iodine tablets. Make sure you got those.
Yeah.
You know, and that was it. And nobody ever asked the why. Are we really preparing our soldiers to deal with trauma on the battlefield? Now, they did eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, when the war kicked off, obviously, we started really ramping up. Every person has to be able to treat and do medical aid for themselves and their buddies. But early on, man, if 1989, we'd have went to a big major ground war. You know, the units I was in wouldn't have been prepared. Some of the higher speed units, like the Ranger Regiment and, you know, the special operations, I'm sure they were way better prepared than we were, but the average grunt wasn't.
Yeah.
Didn't have any idea. Mm-mm. They were just going to lay on the ground and scream medic as loud as they could.
Yeah, I remember, and I say this when I teach personal security, but I remember shooting, even at Sephardic, and we were still running Berettas back then. Yeah. And shooting, and I was a really good shot. Front sight, and punching like all my rounds in a tiny little hole. And that was the mark of a man, right?
Yeah,
well, I look back now and I'm like, that's stupid. Number one, if you're putting all your rounds in the same place, you're shooting too slow. Speed up, right? And number two, I want to stitch that guy in as many places as possible to make sure, because people don't die when they're shot once. You got to bleed all that red stuff out sometimes, right? You got to hit them in multiple places. And then if I'm front sight, I'm blocking out because I'm focused on the front sight. The back sights are blurred. Target is blurred. I'm not seeing hostile intent, right? Yeah. I'm looking for his hands and seeing hostile intent. So if I'm focused on that front sight the whole time, number one, it's too slow. And number two, I'm not getting a good picture of what that guy is doing, right?
Yeah.
So we teach you how to shoot with alignment. We shoot you how to shoot very, very effectively, but be able, and I like red dots for that. Red dots can superimpose on a target. I can still see his actions. I can still determine hostile intent and shoot very accurately. But a lot of things back then, man, it was the mark of a man. If you could all your bullets in a tiny little hole, it was like, damn, I'm badass, right? Well, but it's too slow.
And the thing is, if you have proper alignment and body position, nobody's ever saying don't use your sights, mm-hmm. but your sights should be running in the background. If you have proper alignment and body position, you get that weapon up and put rounds where they need to be, the sights are going to be where they're supposed to.
And especially the initial one or two, and then you can transition to the sights.
Yeah, then you fight your way, you evolve to your sights.
It's to shoot IDPA all the time. Me and Mike Glover shot together, and I would always be... You know, they put the stats out at the end, and I would always be the most accurate, but I'd never win because I was drilling down on that front sight, and I was just too slow.
Yeah.
And it was a lesson learned for me. I don't mind looking back and going, I did that wrong. I'm going to evolve now.
Well, and this is one of those things where, you know, people come out of the woodwork and they'll go, oh, they're saying use your sights and you should just spray rounds. We're not saying that.
No.
You know, unlike a lot of the people, we've actually shot people in combat and understand the realities of it. And understand that I went through a whole CQB eval, probably the highest trained shooting I was in the military. Our final CQB eval, all you do is shoot for weeks on end. And if I thought back on that eval, I don't remember seeing my red dot once, but all the targets were clean. I had all A zone hits. All the targets are clean. So I did that somehow.
Yeah, it aligned properly. You build that muscle memory and you build that alignment
in. You build that firing solution. You know what's right.
You do. And it takes a little time, but it's so much faster. And so much... so much more efficient.
Yeah, and you can, if you're going to be, even if you disagree with what we just said, bottom line is if you're in a hostile engagement close up with pistol, you know, there's stats on where them, let's just say you're at 5 yards, 5 feet, whatever. When you pull that pistol out, you are not going to go right to your sights. You're going to be looking at that target. You're going to be.
You are.
I don't care what.
There's a stat I heard from the FBI is that most gunfights are 3 rounds, 3 feet and 3 seconds.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard
that. It's funny because when I teach personal security, I'll talk about this. And, you know, when I do the women's class, they're awesome to teach. But when I do the men's class, I can see some eye rolling, you know. And at the end, when we're done, I say, who saw their sights? Because they went through multiple scenarios. Yeah. Nobody.
No.
I said, who thought I was full of shit when I said you're not going to see your sights? Yeah. And they were like, I really did think that. And I was shocking to me. Because you train front sight, front sight, front sight. Yeah. You're lining up in the range because you're trying to be accurate. And that's great. And there's a place for that.
Yeah,
but just understand that there's ways to shoot faster and accurate, especially in close range, that are proven techniques.
Yeah. And again, back to the why, like when you're doing your training, you know, my opinion is that when you're close up with a pistol gunfight, you need to be hard target focused. Mm-hmm. I need to be looking at what that person's doing and why they're doing it and reacting to it, right? So boom, concealed carry situation. I'm going to draw my pistol and go to work. I need to be figuring out what they're doing so I don't go to jail for the rest of my life.
Absolutely.
And then eventually, maybe I move the cover and I can get to my sights and I'm going to use my sights in a more effective manner. That's exactly what we want. But the reality of the situation is what we just said. So if I'm going to the range and I'm just putting bullet holes on top of bullet holes and drilling dots for 6 hours a day, am I really training for what I'm going to encounter? Or am I working it out in a live fire?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
try it. I used to go to the range. Every time I go to a pistol range, and I don't shoot much anymore, I would shoot 6-inch dots, right? Or 3-inch dots. And I would drill down the front sight and I would shoot groups, bum, 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 bum. And then I would speed up and speed up and speed up until I was off paper and then dial it back in. I just stand with a sniper rifle. Every time I go to range, I shoot 1-inch pasties at 100 yards because you can't get away with doing anything wrong and you can just stack them all. But if you do that, shoot accurately a little bit and then try to use alignment to shoot at man-sized targets and you'll be surprised how accurate you can be. That's just one. Let's talk about what you got coming up in January.
January, we're starting everywhere. We got pistol, carbine, everywhere. You know, we have multiple dates. You're gonna have to get on the calendar. They're all posted now. The big thing we're doing now is we're down in Texas at Gritter Outdoors in New Richland or North Richland Hills, Texas. That's gonna be a base of operations, kind of a home base for us in Texas. I want you to get out there and see it. It's a great range facility. It's an indoor range facility. We have like a huge classroom in there we're gonna have access to, and it's a big, what did they say when I was down there? They said, imagine if what they say, North Face and Cabela's had a baby, that'd be Gritter Outdoors. That's what they said. I think that's right.
Yeah.
It's a
very professional organization.
It's a super professional, great range staff, great merchandise, great retail space. They sell everything from Sitka clothing to skis to There's been a change, accessories, silencer, you know, suppressors. Yeah.
There's been a change in the firearms industry over the last. I remember going into a gun shop in like Fayetteville, and you have these disgruntled guys that were in the 82nd, and they talk down to you like you're an idiot. You know what I mean? And you're an 18 Bravo Special Forces weapons guy. They're talking to you like, "What do you want that gun for?" or whatever. Right? It's completely different now. Oh, there's a like Royal Range in Nashville. There's facilities like that, very professional staff, very knowledgeable staff, want to help, want to facilitate you buying a gun and getting trained properly, very educational focused. And I really like that. It's a very comfortable environment for people
Gritter,
to go in.
Gritter is to me the standard for that in Texas. And I know there's a lot of places like, you know, Royal Range that does it too. And there's a lot of places around the country, but that is, you should go in there and take advantage of these places because, we're going to be training down there a lot. We're going to be doing seminars. We're going to move all the field craft stuff that we can down there over the next forever. We're going to we're going to really be in Dallas and in Texas a lot. So keeping a lookout for that. As soon as it thaws out up north, we're going to be hitting up north a lot more. Yeah, we're just we got a lot of training that's been going on, and we've improved the courses or not. We've adjusted the courses to kind of meet market demand and to meet what the customer feedback was. I listened to the customer feedback. That's one of the reasons for the name change. I kind of thought that. You know, what does Gunfighter 1 versus Gunfighter 2 really mean if I'm not a, there's no quantifiable things there. So I want people to understand we're going to be posting some course videos where our instructors are going to be on there talking about the course, talking about what it is and what it isn't. So I recommend that you get on our website. There's going to be a link on there where you can click, watch a video. All the equipment's going to be listed on there. And you're going to know the, like we talk about, you're going to know the why you're going to that course. If I'm taking a defensive pistol course, why am I going? And it'll give you the reasons why we think you should be going. And if it fits your model, man, come sign up. Don't you know wait to get in, you know don't wait to go to the gym until you're in shape. If you need work on your shooting, get work on your shooting. Go there. We're going to be professional. We're going to be courteous. It's a no stress environment. It's a learning environment. And I guarantee when you leave the course, you're going to be better prepared than when you showed up, without a doubt.
You don't want to be just going to the range and practicing bad habits and, and ingraining those bad habits into you. We also have personal security around in a bunch of places. We have canning and jarring here in North Carolina. We have a lot of medical training going on. We have survival training. In January, we're going to focus kind of on cold weather stuff, cold weather med, you know, hypothermia, stuff like that. Our guys are putting together some content on generators right now because the power just went out for the 4 days here. The power goes out here every year. We're trying to real training for real people, as John came up with that. And that's what we're trying to focus on here and kind of give you what you need and provide valuable training. So I hope you come train with us. All right. Hey, thanks for listening. If you're still there, until next time. Okay. Bye.